The Scottish Mortgage Podcast, Invest in Progress, is back. Join the managers and their guests as they go behind the scenes of some of the most innovative companies of our time. Companies like Climeworks, who are pioneering technology to remove carbon dioxide from the air. Or Joby, who are at the forefront of a new era of aviation, developing electric air taxis. Or Aurora, who are building software so that trucks can drive themselves. Hear from the leaders of these exceptional businesses on their vision and what the world could look like if they succeed. Available now on all major platforms. Your capital is at risk.
Hello, my name's John Schaefer, and I'm here today with Ben Rogoff, Polar Capital Manager. Ben, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
So Ben, Polar Capital is very supportive of the AI boom. Are you a bit worried that it's been overhyped?
I think anything that goes up as fast as some of the stocks at the centre of the AI story will lend itself to people worrying about frenzies and bubbles and so on. I mean, we've been long-term believers in AI as the next kind of core theme within technology, the next general purpose technology, in fact. And again, we're not here to talk about necessarily funds today, but we launched an AI fund 6.5 years ago designed to be able to capture the opportunities within AI, but also beyond the tech sector as well as within it. And so we've been long-term believers. So the good news is ChatGPT happened at the end of 2022. And really since then, I think the market's been grappling with how big the market opportunity is, what the transformer model means for AI. And I think now we're beginning to see that manifest in stock prices. Are we worried about it? No, we're actually leaning into the theme. We have, you know, around 85% of the portfolio in our global tech UCITS product, and slightly less in our investment trust, exposed to the AI theme through enablers and beneficiaries. And we take profits in odd, you know, names now and again, and we reallocate capital within that bucket. But it's a very large part of the portfolio. We've really leaned into the AI theme because we're super excited about it.
But obviously, share prices have sort of catapulted to the moon here. Are you still not a little bit worried that there's going to be a rebasing of those prices?
I think what's happening is we're in the sort of foothills of an infrastructure build around AI workloads. And I think that it's really important for people to understand, or at least in our opinion, what NVIDIA is enjoying today, this idea of sort of accelerated compute, GPU-centric compute, is really the building of a new infrastructure layer, a new architecture for tech, designed to really handle AI workloads. So the $1 trillion of data center infrastructure that we've put in place as an industry over however many umpteen years is really not been built to handle training and inference workloads for AI. And so as a result of that, we're really 3.25 quarters in to building out infrastructure that can handle the sort of stuff that we expect to see more of, ChatGPT, but also, you know, other large language model workloads and so on. So, get back to your question. The share price moves reflect, in our opinion, largely the upside to earnings and to market revisions associated with AI. For example, you know, the forward PE on NVIDIA, until very recently, I think, was actually lower than it was a year earlier because the upward revisions in earnings are actually greater than the share price move. So I think you have to reference back to what's happened to earnings numbers. And you know, the data center business at NVIDIA is going to do, I think, just $18 billion in a quarter. So these numbers are unheard of. In fact, this is sort of growth, unprecedented growth at scale. And I think that's really hard for investors to get their arms around. But again, we come back to the idea that so far, at least, the share prices do not look divorced from the underlying growth around AI.
Looking at the Global Technology Fund, I mean, do investors really need all this giant cap tech exposure? They're getting this through index funds.
Well, that's true. I mean, obviously, Magnificent Seven has been the sort of focus of tech markets now for quite a while. We've been very luckily, you know, well exposed to those stocks, albeit in some cases overweight, in other cases underweight. Do they need to use an active manager to get those stocks? No. Candidly, they're even better represented in ETFs than they are in our portfolio. For what it's worth, we think it's worth just touching on this, which is that obviously we can call them the Mag 7, but that could be the Fab 4 or the Famous 5, and, you know, who knows? In other words, the constituents of this select group can change. So far this year, you've already seen Apple having a much tougher time. Sales in China are tough. Tesla, even tougher time. Now, we own both Apple and Tesla, but both are now small positions in the portfolio. So I'd come back to the idea that this is a select group of companies, but the variance between the company's performance is actually, these are not sort of monolithic. These are quite different companies, albeit they share characteristics in the form of sort of natural monopoly status. So, you know, Apple dominates smartphone profits. Tesla really is driving the EV market, no pun intended, and so on, Google in advertising and others. But I think what we've been good at is obviously participating in these unusual investments. They're really non-fungible assets that have done exceptionally well over a series of years because the businesses have done exceptionally well. Investors will need to know when to get off those stocks. And I think it's something that is very easy to forget, that there was a time where IBM was a wonderful stock and Warren Buffett owned loads of it, and then it actually was anachronistic in our opinion and no longer participated in the cloud story. There will be a point where companies like Alphabet, where we're now meaningfully underweight actually, Apple, where we've probably never been more underweight, are stocks that may be falling into the shadows as it relates to AI, and you're going to, I think, need an active manager to help you out of those stocks, just as you might have, you know, been grateful for them getting you in them in the first place.
You don't think Apple could have a bit of a return on generative AI, perhaps?
Absolutely, and you know, underestimate these companies at your peril, because these are amongst the best companies in the world. It's very easy to forget that when one looks at performance and, you know, the crowding out last year and what did the S&P 493 do and, you know, that sort of stuff. But in the end, these are phenomenal businesses with cash flows and balance sheets that enable them to have a stab at just about anything they want. So, you know, I think Apple could come back. They've got this Worldwide Developer Conference in, I think, June, where the market is hopeful that they might be able to articulate better a Gen AI story. We're actually quite excited about the idea of Edge AI. The idea that you're going to need new smartphones and PCs potentially to be able to embrace AI workloads, because frankly, the PCs we've got are ancient and the smartphones that we have are not really designed around AI. So there is an opportunity certainly for Apple to reinvent
itself. To sell hardware.
Yes, yeah. Indeed. And I mean, we have to wait and see what AI means to Apple. But if you look at, for example, what the requirements are for PCs, you know, most of the world's PCs can't support the amount of the requirements that, you know, I think 40 or 45 tops is the power required in a PC. And frankly, they're not around today. So there is an upgrade cycle coming if you believe that AI is going to permeate through the enterprise.
I wanted to look at active share in the UCITS fund. It's around 54%. That's quite low, is it not?
Well, it's a funny one, active share, because, there's two things to say here. Firstly, I understand why the industry is worried about active share, because in a performance-related industry, and obviously where people are charging fees, then everybody wants to feel like those fees are being deployed in a way that maybe we couldn't do ourselves. But if you go back just to 2023 and the Mag 7 performance, actually, you know, the higher your active share, the more challenging the year was. And that's not meant in a sort of, I'm not trying to be rude about that, but just as a reminder that there's no harm or shame in expressing the best that the index has to offer within an actively managed portfolio, which is exactly what we've done over the years in Apple and Google and Microsoft and so on. Getting back to the question though, when you are in a sort of a particular sector, it's actually hard to have much higher active share than that if you're going to have Nvidia, for example, that right now is 10.5% of our index. Now, we're underweight that because we have to be by law. But the point I'm trying to make is there's 10 right there in the index that really is at the epicenter of AI. And so on you go. So if you like Microsoft, it's hard for us. So I think you could get to 40 or 50% passive exposure in six or seven companies that are world-class companies.
Perhaps I could reframe this. If you didn't have the UCITS 10% rules, would you have more than 10% in NVIDIA?
Candidly, actually, in the case of the investment trust that I manage, we are less limited in that front. In fact, we're able to go up to 15%, assuming that the index position is 15%. So I can't be overweight beyond 10%. But so actually there's an actual litmus test. And actually we do on occasion go above 10. Again, underweight or neutral the index on occasion. But candidly, we are a team of 10. We are, you know, big fish in a small pond, but we run a large amount of money in technology dedicated funds. And with a team of 10, surely the plan must be to be able to build a portfolio of companies that can deliver more growth in the index. And actually, the idea of swapping sort of relative risk, i.e. not having enough of something that's really big in the bench, for absolute risk, i.e. I've got an enormous position in one name, it doesn't really fill us with joy. So I think even without the UCIT requirements, we would be reticent to go much above 10, because we should be able to find other ways to play exciting themes with a team of 10 people.
Let's have a look at the performance of the 4.6 billion UCITS fund. You have failed to beat your benchmark over 3 and 5 years quite significantly. What's gone wrong?
Well, I think the market's been challenging. I mean, I guess people always say that when things are on the wrong side of benchmarks, but the benchmark has been dominated by the very largest companies. And so, again, the idea that we're talking about Mag 7 reflects this incredible. And I mean, I've done this for more than 20-something years, and the crowding out in large caps is incredible, I think probably without precedent in my career. And, you know, to put it into context, I think, you know, small caps, if you look at, say, the Russell Small Cap Tech Index, and you compare it to the Russell Large Cap Tech Index as a way to think about that mega cap crowding out. I think over the five-year time frame, large caps have outperformed by more than 150%, which is astonishing. So that's a headwind that almost all active managers have had to deal with, which is that the average tech stock has performed vastly less well than headline benchmarks. And I think that, candidly, has been one of the biggest challenges that we and others have faced. I'd also call out the fact that we have had this incredible COVID period where, you know, early in the pandemic, you had this incredible pull forward of demand. You know, think Peloton, think some of the worst, you know, examples of businesses that really performed incredibly well. We saw a big expansion of valuations, not just because of fundamentals, but also because of zero interest rates.
Yeah.
Of course, the period that you're now referring to is kind of capturing the deflation of those valuations. So actually, if you look at the cohort of very expensive growth stocks, you know, we've had incredible compression in valuations. And so, again, easier to see in chart form than to express verbally. But again, within the context of my career, we've never seen a compression in valuations so profound. So I think crowding out of mega caps, natural monopolies, we've owned them but not enough. The compression in next generation valuations has been, you know, very severe and an incredible up and down. Thankfully, we feel like we're on the up again. We were strong last year and, you know, we're off to a great start in 2024 and again, still very early days. The one other thing I might add is, like I said, we're in good company. So over those time frames, we might be third quartile over 3 years, but we're second quartile over five, we're first quartile over one, and we're sort of first decile this year.
What about 2022? That looked particularly disastrous. You know, the fund was down 32% compared to, you know, with the benchmark, which is down 27%. You know, what made it underperform?
I wouldn't say disastrous. I think, again, we were in reasonable company. I think that it was the other side of the trade that the prior year was obviously good for tech. Actually, towards the tail end of the year, we didn't do as well as we'd like to have done, partly because valuations had expanded so far that we kind of got off maybe a little early. We had a very strong prior year to that. So yeah, on the way down, difficult. I think, again, if you look at growth-centric managers like we are, you know, we don't buy ballast, we don't do value, we don't buy things that might fall less just because they're, you know, non-participants in tech. This is a growth portfolio. And, you know, I think actually we did okay. And I think that when you look at that, I mean, again, relative to what we might have expected to do given our growth centricity, the only other point I would make is that some of the up move we saw in 23, of course, was a reaction to that last leg down in 2022. And so when you think about the Mag 7, you know, performance, our big we had a, you know, really big year last year. And some of that obviously needs to be married against the fact that the end of 2022 was pretty tricky.
Last year you had sort of some reasonable outflows. I mean, and over 3 years, you're looking at, over 2 billion in outflows. Are you surprised by that?
I mean, in the end, the client is always right. We just sort of, you know, we just carry on trying to invest in the best way we can. You know, I think equity market flows were very difficult for the industry. I don't think we were, particularly an exception. I think the tech market was a real challenge last year. So, you know, if you think about where we started last year, fundamentals were very tricky. Tech sector was trading back at sort of par with the market. You know, kind of 12 months later, now looks like an incredible opportunity. But at that time, inflation was sort of running amok and valuations were compressing everywhere. And, you know, you had Tesla down 70% or something in 2022. So some extraordinary backdrop to the market. At the same time, you have risk-free rates moving higher and investors thinking, blimey, I'm being paid for the first time in cash. And so you saw the cash flow, the flows into money market funds are extraordinary. And so, and this is not meant rudely to my clients because we love them all, but I think, you know, money was pouring into money market funds. And of course, certainly in the tech market, it ended up being a great opportunity to buy the market and few did. So thankfully, we've still got, you know, great size products that we've got very happy investors in, I hope, based on, you know, more recent performance. But just to come back to this idea that then it becomes really challenging. Like, what do you do when a tech sector moves in the way that it's just moved? And we've gone from sort of 1x the market multiple to like 1.4 times the market multiple with AI at the center of that revaluation. And I think if you're in the market, then that's great, but it's kind of tempting to take profits.
Sure.
And we certainly saw some of that. If you're not in the market and you weren't in the market earlier in the year, and then you've just seen a 40% move in tech valuations relative to the market and obviously more in terms of returns, then it's really hard to get into the market. And I think the net of it were outflows against an incredibly strong backdrop. And, you know, candidly, we'll see what happens this year.
We could be going into sort of a decade of higher rates.
True.
Can tech still perform in that environment?
Well, I mean, our take on 2024 is that, well, our hope, I should say, but our base case is that inflation is beginning to normalise. Again, at what pace the last bit down kind of happens is unknown to us and probably central banks. So in the end, we're not going to hang our hat on that. But our base case is that we normalise on inflation. And against that backdrop, tech should do pretty well. I mean, that's disinflation. That's a global economy that's sort of doing okay, ex-China at this point. Slow okay growth, disinflationary backdrop, tech sector being able to deliver meaningfully more growth actually is a pretty good recipe for the tech sector. And of course, we're ignoring the elephant, the really good elephant in the room, which is AI, which is becoming a business imperative, as it should. And so I feel actually the market backdrop in our base case should be pretty supportive for the tech sector.
We've already touched on this, but are you still confident in the Magnificent Seven sort of going into the rest of the year?
Well, I think that you have to think of them individually, actually, as stocks. And so, for example, Microsoft, you know, again, we don't have a maxed position in the portfolio, but we're constructive against obviously a much larger benchmark. I think maybe 14 or 15% of our benchmark. So we can't hold that much, but we like the stock very much. They've got the Copilot story. They've got AI infusing Azure growth. So we're happy to own that. Apple, as I said, we've never been more underweight. You know, that's probably 8-9% underweight the index right now. So there we're nervous about smartphone trends in China particularly, but also where does the company fall out on AI? Tesla, we're sort of a holding position, something like 50 basis points, watching it, because there's the kernel of the most incredible AI story at Tesla. If they can deliver on full self-driving, all of a sudden this story goes from being a sort of slightly beleaguered EV, the best of a bad bunch of EV stories right now, to becoming a fantastic AI story. So we've kept a bit there. So I think the punchline is we're reasonably constructive on the Mag 7 space. We think they can deliver positive returns. We're hopeful that the market will broaden, and we're not certain, but we're confident that AI stocks will drive performance this year.
I wanted to follow on that confidence in AI. Mm. In AI. Where do you think it is overhyped? Where are you worried in AI?
That's a great question, actually, because stocks will be pulled in to the sort of maelstrom that is AI. You know, Nvidia is the company making most of the money today. If you look at the bill of materials of an AI server versus the a general purpose server that preceded it, the bill of materials is 25 times higher. Just to put it into context, that's the opportunity set when you ship an AI server. And much of that incremental content is going to Nvidia. Now, we're hopeful that AMD will be able to muscle in. We've got a very big active bet in AMD. We have had for actually maybe more than a decade. I mean, this is a company that we know as well as anyone, we would argue. And they will, the industry is looking for a second source of GPUs or of accelerated compute, and we're very confident in that. So the point I'm trying to make here is that these are the businesses that are actually seeing the revenue dollars. And then there are a whole bunch of ancillary companies that we hope will benefit from, I don't know, selling higher quality printed circuit boards or materials that you didn't need before but that you need today, sort of nuts and bolts of an AI server. Those companies should all do well, and we believe strongly that they are actually in the slipstream of AI spend. However, I've seen this many times before with many other themes, which is that there will always be other companies pulled into an investment story that may or may not be actual participants. And at the moment in the market, you're seeing the software sector starting to sort the wheat from the chaff, in that everybody has a generative AI story.
Could you give an example?
Well, I'd rather not talk negatively about companies, but I think that the idea, let's take Snowflake, which was a stock that we owned in the portfolio. And again, we have utter respect for that company and for the management team. We've followed them for, again, more than a decade. And we had a small position in that company. And recently the stock had a pretty tough time. Company's CEO has stepped away, and the business reset growth. And again, there's macro stuff going on, and it may have nothing to do with AI. The point I'm trying to make is that the move down in the stock is at least in part reflecting the fact that it was lifted by the hope that it would participate in sorting out data in anticipation of then rolling out AI across enterprises. And that may still be true, but the challenge in the market, of course, is that nearly every AI beneficiary or enabler, as we see them, are still only going to have small portions of their business actually impacted at this point, because we are really early in the AI story. So the way I think about it is this, which is expect volatility, expect lots of narrative shifts around businesses. Take Adobe, where we have a small position. The company was perceived initially as a loser from ChatGPT and generative AI. And then they launched Firefly, 4.5 billion images downloaded. The stock is then reimagined as an AI winner.
Yep.
And then very recently, you've seen OpenAI launch this text-to-video, it's not launched, excuse me, but demoed Sora. And it's the most astonishing demo I think I've ever seen in my career. Yep. And Adobe stock is down 7%. So again, at this point, there have been no negative impacts to the Adobe business model, but the stock trades with this incredible narrative swings. Yep. And I think that's right, by the way, in that we are at the very beginnings of an AI story that has the potential to disrupt existing profit pools outside of the tech sector, but also within them. And so one should expect those narrative swings to continue until, if you like, the fog has lifted and winners become more apparent.
Could you talk about some of the stocks that you've added and maybe cut from the UCITS fund?
So at the beginning of last year, we articulated via fact sheets and presentations and so on that we were adjusting our investment approach ever so slightly. And again, Nick and I have worked together for nearly 2 decades. We very seldom do this because we have a shared passion for investing in growth companies that deliver more growth in the index at hopefully a modest premium valuation-wise. Some years ago, we observed that small caps, mid caps were going to struggle in a world of natural monopolies, data, scale, all of the stuff around the cloud. And now what purport is turning into AI, this data advantage, incumbency, and natural monopoly status. So we adjusted our portfolios then for that. So we are still multi-cap, but we very much move our portfolios towards the bigger end of where we might have been 10 years ago. We've made a similar adjustment at the beginning of last year, where we felt that really this AI story was so strong that the arrival of transformer models and ChatGPT really was the beginning of something that we've been waiting for a long time. So we introduced this idea of an AI lens. And again, it's a metaphor, obviously not an actual thing you can buy in a shop, although I would buy one if there was. And the idea really is to try and think, how does a theme and stock fit within this sort of, where the loci of compute is all about AI. And so with that in mind, we've pulled in our exposure, we're going to reduce meaningfully our exposure to areas that we don't see as being really involved in AI.
Did you get some stock examples?
Well, like, so for example, electric vehicles. Now they're having a tougher time based on, you know, supply is now back to normal, demand is being pinched by higher rates and other stuff.
So did you reduce Tesla?
So, well, we actually kept Tesla. We may have reduced it and we may have traded around the core position, but actually onsemi is a great example of a company where, you know, we've owned it for a long time. It's a beneficiary of more semiconductor content in electric vehicles, and electric vehicles are growing in the mix. So what's not to like? And the business has been run very well, and they had a mishap on earnings and we exited. And we just exited cleanly. And we sold BYD, for example. We also exited areas like environmental
tech. Why did you sell BYD?
A profit-taking, candidly. We were kind of lucky with that one. But but the electric vehicle story, until AV, autonomous vehicles, happens, electric vehicles have really very little to do with the AI story. So we reduced there. We reduced an environmental tech, for example. We actually took China down to 0 in the portfolio. So there's some examples of what we've been
selling. And was that just
selling.
Sort of concerns of the macro?
Yes, actually, candidly, mostly to do with the macro. In the end, we're not experts on macro, but when China growth is at its lowest level in however long, you know, the range of outcomes there has become, I think, much less attractive. And there's just this incredible pull back towards the AI story. And there are some Chinese AI assets, like Baidu, which we've owned in the past, for its Ernie chatbot. And yet there's something slightly uncomfortable about investing in AI stories in a sort of closed environment that is China. You know, the inability for Baidu to do a live demo of its product, maybe because it didn't want to show the answers in real time because it maybe would have fallen foul of government. We get it, this is all rumour, but the point I'm trying to make is there's somewhat of an incompatibility between...
You find it still a little bit opaque.
Very much so, but also the macro outcomes may not be great. On the buy side, what we've been doing, well, we've been adding to AI, as you would imagine. So we continue to add to areas like networking. So, for example, Arista Networks, which makes switches that are used in hyperscale data centers, is a name we've liked for years. We've added to it. We've more recently added to a company called Coherent, which is involved in the sort of subsystem level in optics. If we're right, and AI will require, well, we see it already in NVIDIA's Hopper, where you're starting to use optical components very close to the chips in order to improve the subsystem performance. And we think that optics become more interesting again for the first time since the dot-com bubble, candidly. Sure. So a few things around AI, and then in Asia, companies that are involved in materials, PCBs.
Taiwan Semiconductor.
Yeah, we've added to TSMC. Yeah. Ultimately, you know, all of the GPUs go through TSMC as is, and others will try to, you know, muscle in. Samsung we own, Intel we don't, but they are trying to get a foothold in AI. But right now, all of the NVIDIA GPUs are going through Taiwan Semi. And so Taiwan Semi, Advantest in Japan, which is the tester of NVIDIA GPU.
Could you talk about the approach of the technology trust and how it differs from the UCITS fund?
Well, apart from having me as the sort of lead and the other, and the UCITS having Nick as the lead.
One,
oh, well, you know, on any given Sunday, I mean, actually, the performance through the cycle has been remarkably similar. And I say remarkably, but Nick and I sit almost the same distance that you and I sit from each other right now. So we've worked together for a very long time. We have a shared passion in this. We've built a team and a nice business. And so we would naturally share themes, stocks. I think the principal differences to call out would be that the UCITS fund is consistently further from the benchmark than the trust. So the trust right now has an active share of 45%. You cited the UCITS, you know, sort of 1,000 basis points higher than that. That's about right. If you think about the number of stocks, the trust will have 30 or 40 more names. Of those extra names, maybe a third of them are benchmark related. So for example, I may have a small position in SAP, because even though we've not been too positive about SAP over the years, actually they've got a much more interesting story today. I'm going to cover some of the index position. In the case of the UCITS, Nick wouldn't do that. So there's a portion of ballast, but good ballast. And sometimes that's really helpful ballast, because we've only ended up closing off bets that have really paid off to be underweight. We then can close them, and we're doing that right now with SAP, but we're not doing that in the UCITS. And then there's a 10 or 15, 20 stocks possibly in the tail of PCT. We're a very large team, and there are names that perhaps I'd like 20 basis points in, 25 basis points in, that Nick won't do because he has a minimum position size of 50 basis points. So there are some differences at the margin, but where the bets are big, where the themes matter, they're the same.
It's also running at more than 10% discount. Is there any way, how would you like to sort of close that? Is it share buybacks?
The company is buying back the stock pretty much every day. Yeah. And you know, we're a very liquid portfolio, and I think that you know, it's actually, I think you asked some time ago, you know, about AI bubbles, and if you go back to the 90s, there are lots of things today that people will want to call out as being bubble-esque. If you went back to the 90s and looked at this trust traded consistently at a premium, and I think it peaked at some crazy number. I wasn't involved at Polar at that time; I was elsewhere. But I think peaked out at some 25% premium. We're currently at a discount. You know, I think if the world was super excited about AI or was half as excited about AI as we are, we might expect that discount to be narrower. Now, I should point out that discounts are sort of prevalent across the industry, and we're very much in line with our closest peers. We're in line with, you know, ATT, which is one of our closer peers. We're in line with Herald, where we have a much higher liquidity profile because they're obviously focused on small caps. Again, all very well-run companies. So just trying to point out that we're in good company. Sure. And I think it reflects industry-wide issues. There's certainly been wealth manager consolidation that I think is, you know, creating this opportunity. And candidly, I think it is an opportunity. I can't really give people investment advice, but for my own personal account, I own lots of the trust. The company is buying back the stock daily. It's accretive for us to do so. And, you know, again, I think for long-term holders, discounts do represent opportunities, but obviously they can move up and down over shorter term frames.
Let's have a look at the new AI fund, the 400 million fund. Could you maybe explain again sort of what the difference is there? We've talked about AI a lot, especially in both the UCITS fund and the trust. What's the function of this? Are there sort of opportunities outside of large caps here?
Very much so. And so just to recap, so 6.5 years ago or thereabouts, we launched this third fund. And the idea at that time was really to take advantage of the AI story as it played out. We were careful not to call it an AI fund 6.5 years ago, because there was probably a handful of stocks that were publicly traded that were real AI stories. So we first called it the Automation and AI Fund, and more recently we changed the name to AI because we felt that this sort of Rubicon had been crossed. It was time to be all in on AI. But just to put that into context, why launch this fund? Because you could argue we've got 85% of our technology funds in AI, so what's the purpose of this third product? And the answer to that question is that we felt then, and even more so today, that some of the biggest disruptions and opportunities will come beyond the border, if you like, or the edges of tech. And so we wanted a vehicle that would enable us to be able to find, I don't know, relics and say, here is an opportunity for us to invest in a business where the core product is an information system. But if you could apply AI to that and all of the data, the proprietary data that company has, say, around legal, that could turn this business into something that looked much more like a decision-making tool like Bloomberg. Okay. And in that world, the price points for a Lexus plus AI, which is just being released right now would be meaningfully higher than. Now again, I'm not here to pitch the Relic story, but that is a business that would fall, we feel, beyond the remit of our tech fund. We think that some of the biggest disruption will play out in verticals like education, like in law, like in areas that may be difficult for us to capture, where in the tech funds, where we're going to be naturally focused on the infrastructure bit of this story and less on the beneficiaries beyond tech.
Potentially some slightly more niche areas.
Well, right? I mean, Intuitive Surgical in healthcare, or Relics in legal and education. I mean, we own Walmart, where we believe they have a massive data advantage, and the application of AI can profoundly changed the profit margins of that business. And right now, if you imagine that the disruption of AI is modest because we're just starting, but the opportunity set outside of tech should only expand. And so we feel that it is absolutely the right place to be. And yes, the two funds, you know, right now the AI fund has 50% of the portfolio roughly in tech and 50% of the portfolio beyond tech. As the opportunity set evolves, then it may well be that some of the best opportunities are really better handled within the AI fund than they are today in the tech fund. But right now we're building the rails for a new infrastructure, and I think that favours all of our approaches.
Looking more broadly at Polar Capital as a business, you're very reliant on tech. Obviously, this is your wheelhouse, but is it too much?
Well, you'll have to ask Gavin. I mean, I'm not the CEO of the business. I've been at Polar for a very long time. I would say that, you know, we were launched. The business was built around the tech franchise that Brian Ashford Russell, Tim Woolley built. And you know, I've been very lucky to have been at Polar for a very long time. In fact, what is that now? 21 and a bit years. And I think during my time at Polar, we've always been a very large part of the business. And we're delighted about that. The business has added some really interesting legs. And again, this is speaking as an amateur, because I'm a shareholder, but I'm not involved in the running of the businesses. I have a business of my own to run in the tech franchise with Nick. But I think we've added some great teams over the years. I think we've got some real world-class franchises. We've been lucky that we've focused on, you know, areas like healthcare, our biotech fund, like lots of insurance guys are outstanding. We've got some really good businesses at Polar. And I think the challenge of diversifying away from tech has been that tech has been an incredible performer. And I was looking recently at the compound returns to the trust, and I think it's something like 20% over 10 years. You try diversifying away from a business that's growing at 20% per annum, it's difficult. Yeah. And so I think it's a very high quality problem to have. We're delighted to be at Polar. It's a wonderful business. I've been, honestly, marrying my wife, having children, joining Polar. They're up there with some of the best things I've done as a person.
Excellent. And on that note, Ben, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
The Scottish Mortgage Podcast, Invest in Progress, is back. Join the managers and their guests as they go behind the scenes of some of the most innovative companies of our time. Companies like Climeworks, who are pioneering technology to remove carbon dioxide from the air. Or Zobi, who are at the forefront of a new era of aviation, developing electric air taxis. Or Aurora, who are building software so that trucks can drive themselves. Hear from the leaders of these exceptional businesses on their vision and what the world could look like if they succeed. Available now on all major platforms. Your capital is at risk.